investigator keeping tabs on him, on Clark. The AG approved it only this morning. I'm trusting you with that information. It's not for public knowledge. Natch. I spoke to the investigator just before leaving the office. He reported that Eben is zipping around the city in a spanking new $250,000 car. He's buying designer clothes, designer shoes, living the life of royalty. She placed her fingertips in the center of her forehead and rubbed them up and down. I have a real problem with that. After his visit to the special care facility, Zach had a real problem with it too. He took a look around the dining room, relieved to see that it wasn't crowded. Locals had become accustomed to seeing him in and around, so they rarely approached him anymore. The tall back of the booth behind Kate provided seclusion and would keep them from being overheard. He said, "We can order whenever you're ready." His tone must have signaled her that he wasn't yet ready, because she told him she could wait. He nodded.
"I want to ask you a question."
"All right."
"Are you a star prosecutor?"
She opened her mouth to speak, but he headed her off.
"Don't be modest."
"Well, I'm not a novice. I paid my dues in a county DA's office, much like the one here. The area was rife with meth labs and opioid supply chains. I went after them and got convictions. My win-loss record helped me jump the line of lawyers hoping for a position in the Attorney General's office."
"Figured that," he said. "What I want to know is if the AG assigned you this case or if you took it upon yourself."
"As I told you, I did background and research for Clark's early release hearing. The arguments against any reduction of his sentence were so compelling, the judge's ruling floored me. I went to the big boss himself and made a case for pursuing a more serious charge against Clark once he was out."
"And Rebecca officially deceased?"
"Yes," she said, looking rueful. The AG actually winced. He reeled off a long list of the difficulties and delicate issues involved. He used adjectives like polarizing and incendiary, all of which he stressed are trapdoors for a prosecutor. "And then there's Eben's distinguished bloodline. Never mind that he robbed Rebecca of her life that night, even if she didn't die. Bottom line, the AG would rather avoid the matter until after the November election. I argued that if we wait, Eben will fly the coop. So I stuck to my guns and cited the precedent-setting cases that made headlines and were debated on national programs like Face the Nation. He has an ego, so he liked the sound of that, and after exhaustive discussion, gave me leave to approach you."
"To test the temperature of the water," Zach said.
"Yes, but it was conditional. He reminded me of all the moral and ethical implications and advised that I approach you with caution, not with shock and awe." She reached for her glass, but rolled the stem between her fingers without picking it up. "He also stipulated that if you declined even to consider a change of course for Rebecca, I was to let it go and apply no pressure to you whatsoever." Having made the admission, she met his gaze head on. Studying her, he rubbed his index finger back and forth across his lips. His thoughtful scrutiny made her squirm.
"What?" "I don't think you're going to let it go. I know you're beating the drum for law and order and all that, but there are 1,000 criminals you could target to bring to justice without all the trapdoors. Why are you fixated on Eben Clark?"
"I'm not fixated.
Why, Kate?"
She tilted her chin up.
"I'm an officer of the court. I want justice for Rebecca. That's all the explanation you need."
He knew there was more to it than that, but he'd pushed her as far as he could, for the moment. He took a sip of bourbon, then said in a low tone,
"I went to see Rebecca yesterday."
To Kate's credit, she didn't begin peppering him with questions. Rather, she looked at him with a mix of compassion and expectation.
"It was a quick trip," he said. "I didn't have to be there long to fully grasp the quality of her life, which amounts to no quality."
He took another sip of his whiskey.
"I think I mentioned Bing to you."
Kate dipped her chin in acknowledgement.
On my way back, I went to see him. He can be as ornery as hell, but I haven't listened to him and heeded his advice for all these years because he talks nonsense.
He gave a dry laugh and scratched his eyebrow with his thumbnail.
I didn't ask his advice before marrying Rebecca. Look how that turned out. Anyway, last night I laid it all out for him, starting with your coming out of nowhere and dropping this bomb on me. For half an hour, I talked nonstop, but Bing was more concise. After I'd gone off on all these tangents, he honed things down to this.
He raised his index finger.
He said that the person most affected by my decision is the person I've given the least consideration.
She spoke the name on a soft breath.
Rebecca.
Yeah. When it happened, many said she'd gotten no better than she deserved for going into a bedroom while stoned with three men. She lived wildly, recklessly, and paid the price.
He paused, picked up his glass, and looked down into the bourbon.
Those harsh judges should have to spend time, only a brief time, in that hospital room with her. Nobody deserves having to exist like that.
He shot the whiskey and set down his glass.
I'm giving you no guarantee, Kate. It's got to be my decision, and I won't be browbeaten or rushed into making it. But I've come around to thinking that maybe Rebecca has been victimized long enough, and not only by Eben Clark, but by her father and me.
They ordered. During their meal, they didn't talk about anything relating to Rebecca. Kate, and she assumed Zek also, needed a breather. As she stirred a dollop of cream into her after-dinner coffee, she said, Bing seems to be an important and trusted person in your life.
The most trusted. He sort of filled in for my parents when they were killed in a car wreck.
I read about that in an article I found online. I'm sorry.
Me too. They were driving home from a game my freshman year at Clemson. Nobody's fault, just a dreadful accident. Four fatalities in all. A number to everybody else. To me, a monumental loss.
You were close. He smiled.
Very. Dad was my best buddy and biggest fan. Mom was beautiful. Gracious. Exceptional people, really. Both of them.
What's your favorite memory?
Geez, there are so many. But a standout is the day I signed my letter of intent with Clemson. Full athletic scholarship. Mom and Dad were so proud. They celebrated big. Had all their friends over for a cookout. A few months later, they were gone.
He snapped his fingers. No siblings?
No, just me. That's when Bing took over the parental role, although he never came right out and said it, and I probably would have decked him if he had. Nobody could have replaced my mom and dad. But in his own grouchy way, he nursed me through that year, kept me in line, focused. Thanks to him, I came out strong my sophomore and junior years.
And thanks to you, the Tigers won the national championship your senior year. At his arch look, she added, I did my homework.
Of course you did.
He smiled before turning reflective again.
It was tough losing my parents so suddenly like that. But later, I looked on it as a blessing of sorts. They didn't have to go through that scandalous mess with me, and they weren't around to watch my fall from grace.
Maybe if they had been around, things wouldn't have turned out as they did.
Maybe.
He gave a dry laugh.
Rebecca sure as hell wouldn't have been their pick for a daughter-in-law.
Kate hesitated, then asked something she'd been wanting to ask.
How'd you two meet?
She hung out in the clubs known to be gathering places for team members. There were always these girls, all dolled up and available. You know.
Looking for action with a hot jock.
Or the man with the it factor of the moment. That was her job.
Her job? What do you mean?
She'd gone to cosmetology school, something like that. But she made a career of looking great and showing up at happenings, events, PGA tournaments, movie premieres, like that. Anywhere she'd be seen rubbing elbows with the glitterati.
How did she support herself? He gave a dry chuckle.
She didn't have to. Her catch of the day would put her up in his hotel suite, take her shopping, indulge her until she moved on to the next guy.
Which ultimately wound up being you.
Yeah. That season there was a lot of buzz about my throwing arm and the team going all the way to the Super Bowl.
With bitterness, he added.
And then, following that win, there was a lot of chatter about my new contract. After the amount of it was reported, Rebecca came on strong. She made herself noticed among the other groupies. Every time I turned around, there she was. One night, I went home with her. 6 weeks later, we were saying boozy I-dos in a wedding chapel in Vegas. I'm a little vague on exactly how we got there. I don't recall actually proposing.
He shook his head with self-deprecation.
Jesus, I was so full of myself. I felt invincible. The only serious rift Bing and I ever had was when I skipped 2 days of spring training. He came storming to our house, dragged me out of bed, backed me into the wall, and told me I had to be the most arrogant, obnoxious, blankety-blank on the planet, and he wanted nothing to do with my big-headed self.
But he took you back.
Yeah, when I came crawling to him after 3 months of wedded bliss, I'd found out that Rebecca was in the throes of her first fling.
Ouch.
Oh, don't feel sorry for me. When I heard about her affair, I started having fun on the side, too. Women were easy to come by. What escaped me were concepts like humility, gratitude, common sense, responsibility, vital stuff like that.
How old were you, Zach? 26? 27? Fame like that is a lot to handle when one is that young.
Young, yes, but mostly stupid and self-congratulatory.
He folded his arms on the table.
Enough. I've spilled my guts. Tell me one of your deep, dark secrets.
She laughed. I'm boring.
You're a rock star in your field.
Not yet, but I'm giving it the good old college try.
What about your parents?
Bob and Jenny. Married 40-something years and still in love. I, too, was an only child.
A brain child, I'll bet.
I have a healthy IQ, a genetic favor. Both my parents were physicians. They're now retired and living on Hilton Head. They play golf every day, preach the merits of sunscreen and fiber, and complain that I don't call often enough. See? Boring.
I wasn't bored, but you told me about them, not you. Come on. One secret. I promise not to tell.
She hunched her shoulders and took a deep breath, lowering her shoulders as she released it. My hair turned white when I was 20 years old.
Heredity?
Neither parent had one gray strand yet. No one could account for it, not even specialists, and we consulted them all. As you can imagine, I was hysterical. I colored it for a while, but that got tedious and expensive. When I considered cancer patients who lose their hair, people with alopecia, I stopped obsessing. So, she framed her head between her hands. People assume that I bleach it, but this is natural.
What color was it?
Brownish.
This suits you better.
Thank you. There. Now you own a deep, dark secret of mine.
I have another one to share.
She grinned. Ooh, do tell.
I've been sitting here for 90-something minutes, through the drinks, the salads, the steaks, and the coffee, all the time wanting to put my mouth against yours.
Chapter 15.
Kate lowered her head and fiddled with the spoon she'd used to stir cream into her coffee.
That can't happen, Zach.
I know. It would be a very bad idea. I know.
He motioned to her left hand, the one still fiddling with the spoon.
You don't wear a ring. Is there a Mr. Lennon?
My dad.
Besides him.
She shook her head. I've never married. I've been in a couple of relationships that eventually fizzled for one reason or another, but mostly from apathy.
I've never been in a relationship.
She looked at him quizzically.
It's true, he said. One-night stands, short-term amusements, but never a relationship. Not even my marriage could be called that. Especially my marriage.
That's very sad.
Tell me. But nothing can happen between us. I know.
She gave him a tepid smile, and he gave her one back, then looked around and realized that only a handful of other diners remained.
Now that we've settled that, you ready?
Even though it wasn't a date, he kept his hand at the small of her back as they walked to the entrance. They thanked the hostess. He pushed open the door and followed Kate out. The rain was really coming down now. She opened her umbrella.
Do you want me to walk you to your truck so you don't get wet? I've played 4 quarters in worse than this. I won't melt.
Thank you for dinner and for talking me into ordering the filet.
You bet. I'll walk with...
He broke off when, out of the corner of his eye, he saw motion near his pickup. Someone was walking along the bed of it on the driver's side. As he watched, whoever it was rounded the rear end and disappeared behind it.
Hey!
Mindless of the downpour, he took off in a sprint, splashing through the puddles that had formed in the parking lot. He rounded the rear end of his truck and nearly collided with a hulk draped in black rain gear who was peering into the bed of his pickup.
Zach saw red. What the fuck are you doing?
Reaching for his shoulder, he spun the guy around.
It was Deputy Dave Morris.
Kate lit out after Zach, battling her umbrella until she gave up and collapsed it. She ran to the rear of the truck where Zach and the deputy were once again in a face-off. Seeing her, Morris smiled in the insidious way that grew more repugnant each time she saw it.
Hi, Kate.
Before she could respond, Zach sidestepped to put his shoulder between her and the deputy.
What the hell are you doing snooping around my truck?
Rainwater was dripping off the wide brim of Morris's hat, which had a fitted plastic cover.
There was another incident of vandalism at Green Ridge last night.
Zach's jaw clenched.
Not my problem. Again, what are you doing around my truck?
I was just wondering if those folks had gotten back at you for perceived offenses against their valuable property.
What are you talking about?
Over here. Morris turned and went around the rear bumper to the passenger side. Kate and Zach followed. From the folds of his slicker, Morris produced a large flashlight and shone it onto the truck, following a jagged furrow that had been dug into it from bumper to bumper.
Someone's keyed it, Morris said. I'm guessing in revenge for the vandalism. Which I didn't do.
Well, holes were punched in newly installed sheetrock last night. Looked like with a ball-peen hammer, something of that sort. Huddled close to Zach, Kate could feel the wrath emanating from him. She said,
Are there any security cameras at the construction site?
They're looking into installing some.
In the meantime, she said, perhaps they should hire guards to protect their valuable property.
That's exactly what I advised, Kate.
The deputy winked at her as though he and she were a two-person alliance.
Presumptuous ass. Zach said, You were just driving past the restaurant and happened to spot that gash in the side of my truck? In the dark? Through the rain?
Morris took umbrage. No, I'd called in an order for pickup. I pulled in over there. He tipped his head toward his vehicle, which looked to Kate like a deliberate move to dump rainwater from the brim of his hat onto Zach. My headlights caught it. I didn't remember seeing it when I was up at your place the other day, so I came to investigate, see if the perp left any clues. I didn't find anything.
No, I'm sure you didn't, Zach said.
Somebody was sending you a message. Morris again shone his flashlight along the gouge and made a sound of regret.
I hope your deductible isn't too high.
Fearing that Zach was about to launch himself at the deputy, Kate said,
You don't want your food order to get cold, Dave.
No. The deputy's eyes sawed back and forth between the two of them. Then he said goodnight, switched off his flashlight, and started across the parking lot toward the restaurant's entrance.
I'm sorry, she murmured to Zach.
She opened the umbrella and held it above the two of them, or tried. She couldn't reach high enough to cover him. His angry expression relaxed.
It's a little late for that to be any good, but here.
He took the umbrella from her, held it over her, and started walking in the direction of her car. She unlocked it with her fob and opened the door. He gave her a hand up, then collapsed the umbrella and passed it to her.
Where are you staying?
She gave him the name of a popular bed and breakfast.
Main house?
One of the cottages.
I'll follow to see that you get safely inside.
That isn't necessary.
I'll follow you.
He closed her car door. He stayed close on her bumper as they drove through the picturesque town center.
Tonight, it was locked up tight. The streets were dark. Arriving at the B&B, she parked in the designated space in front of the cottage, gathered her things, and made a dash for the door, where she turned to wave Zach goodbye.
But he had pulled his truck in beside her car and was getting out. He joined her beneath the narrow overhang.
Open the door, he said. Take a look.
Shaking her head over the absurdity of his precaution, she used the old-fashioned key to unlock the door. Reaching in, she flipped on the light switch. They peered inside.
See? All's well. No boogeyman.
Okay, laugh. But I don't like that guy. I don't trust him. He has a lech for you. He didn't like seeing both our cars in the parking lot of the restaurant, so he stopped and keyed my truck out of spite.
Maybe he didn't.
Her voice lacked the oomph to convince even herself of that.
That gash is deeper than a key would make. His utility belt has everything except a chainsaw on it. But the real giveaway to his guilt was his shit-eating grin.
He is smarmy, she said. I did envy him his slicker, though. I'm afraid your leather jacket may be ruined.
Nah, the more abuse it takes, the better it looks.
Correctly reading his telltale smile, she flipped open one side of his jacket and saw the familiar label. She started laughing and, abashed, bumped the crown of her head against his sternum.
So I was spot on. You were.
He cupped the back of her head and held it there against his chest, which was broad and warm and smelled wonderful. His touch was light and undemanding, but all the more captivating because of his restraint. Everything felt far too right, and therefore was very wrong.
Zach? We can't.
I know.
You keep saying that, but I don't think you understand how unethical, how compromising.
Hell, Kate, you don't have to explain how this would complicate a problem that's already so damn complicated. I get it, okay?
Okay.
She looked up and gave him a soft, weak smile.
Then let's say goodnight. Goodnight.
But neither of them moved. She didn't even realize how incrementally they'd been inclining toward each other until his left hand joined his right to cradle the back of her head, and his face was lowering closer to hers. She closed her eyes. Against her cheek, she felt his breath, warm and fragrant with whiskey, then felt its tickle on the corner of her mouth. His lips made glancing passes across her lower one, whispering,
"Feel free to apply all the pressure on me you like."
Chapter 16. The chiming of Upton's doorbell echoed through his house. Because it wasn't often utilized, it startled him. Since his wife's death, he didn't entertain. Neither did friends visit, except possibly Sid, and those rare occasions were scheduled. He set aside the dense biography he was reading, slid his bare feet into leather slippers, and made his way to his front door. He was not pleased to see Eben on his doorstep, reaching out to ring the bell again.
"I'm here," Upton called through the glass panel.
He disengaged his alarm, unlocked the door, and opened it.
"Hi, Up,"
Eben took in his pajamas and robe.
"A little early for a bedtime, isn't it?" "I wasn't in bed, just relaxing."
Upton looked beyond Eben, hoping that Sid was with him, but the only thing in his semicircular driveway was the shiny sports car.
"Is anything wrong?" "What a coincidence! That's exactly the question I came to ask you. Why don't you invite me in and let's chew the fat?"
With reluctance, Up said,
"Of course, come in. I was in the study."
He motioned for Eben to precede him down the wide central hallway, which he did in a jaunty stride, having a thorough look around as he went.
Not a thing's changed since the last time I was here, and that's been, gosh, how many years?
I'm a creature of habit, Upton said. Since Alice died, the girls have been encouraging me to downsize, but I can't bring myself to leave this house. It's familiar. I know where everything is and how to operate it.
The girls were his two adult daughters. Both were busy juggling careers and families. They called frequently to check on him, but he sensed their monitoring sprang more from obligation than affection. Alice had been the parent in the trenches, the loving, soft-spoken, level-headed, well-oiled motor that had kept the family running smoothly through decades. Since she was gone, he and his daughters were like congenial strangers in search of common ground and things to talk about. It shamed him to acknowledge how little he knew of them as individuals, as persons with interests and ideas and quirks. Much more of his time, his life, had been devoted to Sid and his business dealings, which were extensive, encompassing a grab bag of industries. Up had had far more interaction with Eben than with his own children. If he had it to do over again, he would amend many of the choices he'd made and rearrange his priorities. But unfortunately, the time for making those adjustments had long since passed. He and Eben entered the study and soon were sitting in facing chairs, a cocktail table between them. Eben had poured himself a vodka. Upton declined. He didn't welcome this intrusion and wished to keep it brief. "What's on your mind, Eben?" He was slouched in his chair, legs outstretched and ankles crossed, but Upton recognized posturing when he saw it. Eben wouldn't be here if he weren't stewing over something. Upton had an idea of what that something was, but he wanted to hear it from Eben himself. He began by saying, "Dad told me something rather astonishing this morning." Upton didn't ask what. He waited. "He told me that you had alerted him to a potential," he drew a lazy spiral in the air, "ripple in the pond of my future." He slurped some vodka. "No, let me rephrase with more accuracy. Dad warned me of a potential fucking tsunami." With sudden ferocity, he said, "Why aren't you doing something to stop it?" Upton raised his hands. "At this point, there's nothing I can do. The key word is potential. My responsibility was to inform Sid and you that there's a possibility of such an occurrence."
Wait a minute. Eben slammed his glass down on the table. "All you're going to do is sit twiddling your thumbs until that girl finally gives up the ghost? And then when she does, you'll let this prosecutor pounce on my ass with an arrest warrant for murder? That's the plan?"
"Her name is Rebecca Pratt."
"I know her name. Christ! How could I forget it? She ruined my life."
Upton bit his tongue. The gall of the little prick. Speaking quietly in contrast to Eben's shout and his own inner outrage, he said,
"Others would say just the opposite."
While Eben sat there glowering at him, Upton took a moment to get his temper under better control.
"If Rebecca Pratt had recovered sufficiently to testify at your trial, she could have made a dynamic impact on the jury, and the outcome might not have gone so well for you in terms of sentencing. If she had died, even worse, you would be in Reidsville tonight serving a sentence for manslaughter at best, instead of being free to whiz around in your new Porsche. Either way, she did you a huge favor by becoming suspended in the dreadful state she's in."
Sulking, Eben carried his glass over to the bar and splashed more vodka into it.
"Where is she?"
"In a special care facility in New Orleans."
"What's her status? Do you know?"
"I have an informant on staff who gives me periodic reports. Rebecca remains much the same as she was when she was first admitted."
Eben swiped his hand in front of his face from forehead to chin and back up.
"Nothing there?"
Upton replied with a brusque no.
"How is she otherwise?"
Upton shared what he knew of Rebecca's general health. Eben assimilated the information as he took several belts of vodka.
"And she could stay that way indefinitely? I mean, until old age, right? And die of natural causes?"
in theory, but I'm told that someone in her condition typically doesn't have a long life expectancy.
Great. Just great.
He muttered into his glass before taking a drink. I've got a sword on the back of my neck.
That's if nature takes its course.
That caused Eben to start.
And if someone should decide to speed up nature's course, how long would she last?
Days at most.
Fucking great.
My advice?
Well, Uncle Up, I don't want to put you out any, but as long as I'm here...
His sarcasm warranted a pop on the mouth, but Upton tamped down the impulse.
Leave the country, Eben.
What?
Pick a spot on the globe that appeals to you and hunker down there.
Hunkering doesn't sound like something I would enjoy. For how long?
Upton just looked at him, and when Eben caught his godfather's meaning, he chuffed.
You can't mean forever. Are you crazy?
Again, Upton struggled to keep a lid on his temper.
Listen to me, Eben. The challenges of prosecuting a case like this are as intimidating as walking a tightrope across the Grand Canyon. Crosswinds coming at you from all sides. One misstep would spell disaster. Extradition from another country would compound the challenges tenfold for even the most intrepid prosecutor and greatly reduce the chances of the case ever going to trial.
Eben thought it over, then said in the intractable tone of a child told to eat his broccoli,
No, I don't want to leave the country. I just got home. Besides, running off, disappearing, or even keeping that low profile that you and Dad are so keen on my doing would look like an admission of guilt.
He planted his hand flat against his chest.
I didn't do anything she didn't ask for. She knew what she was getting into when she joined Theo, Cal, and me in that bedroom. Nobody had to talk her into a fucking thing.
He paused and then broke into a laugh. A fitting choice of words. Having had all of his godson he could stomach, Upton pulled himself out of his chair.
It's getting late, Eben, and I have an early morning meeting with Sid tomorrow.
Hold on. Are her parents still Bible thumpers?
Her mother has since died. I'm told her father continues to see her daily. I assume his religious convictions remain rock solid.
So, Eben said, giving an exaggerated shrug. No problem with Holy Joe. Unless I'm mistaken, he was the holdout on pulling the plug. And her ex-husband isn't a concern. When his career went from sugar to shit, he became a drunk and went on the skids.
Upton hesitated. He was disinclined to share too much information, but, at the same time, reminded himself that Eben was his client, by extension, through Sid. He was entitled to be told. And, as distasteful a human being as Eben had turned out to be, he remained his godson, to whom he had sworn an oath to treat him as his own child. With reluctance, he said,
He went to New Orleans.
Who? Bridger? When?
Recently.
How recent?
Yesterday morning. He saw Rebecca, then had a closed-door meeting with the facility's administrator.
Eben paled a bit and shot the remainder of his vodka.
That doesn't mean anything. How often does he visit her?
Never, Eben. This is a first, and I view it as significant.
Well, no shit, Sherlock. When the fuck were you going to get around to telling me about this significant visit?
My source down there wasn't on duty yesterday, so she didn't learn about Mr. Bridger's visit until today. She caught the scuttlebutt among the staff. She wasn't free to share the information with me until late this afternoon, when her shift ended.
Eben was breathing hard, nostrils flaring.
What do you think his visit signifies?
Maybe nothing.
Or...
Or it might be a reaction to your early release and a prompting from a prosecutor.
Dad told me about this prosecutor, a woman. Catherine something.
Lennon.
What do you know about her?
Only that she's been in the AG's office a little over a year and has a reputation for being sharp and aggressive.
That's it?
Isn't that enough?
Nowhere near enough. His hardened features and the coldness of his tone were discomforting. And a bit alarming to Upton.
Eben, please do yourself a service.
Don't blow off our advice about keeping a low profile. It was my duty to make you and Sid aware of what could come about, but I doubt very seriously that it will.
Eben continued to glower at nothing for several seconds, then blinked up and back into focus. His handsome features relaxed. He smiled and clapped Upton on the shoulder.
I've kept you up too long. You look tired, so I'm going to let you go night-night. Thanks for the drink.
He quickly walked out and didn't wait for Upton to see him off. He was already revving his car's engine by the time Upton reached the front door. He watched until the taillights turned out of his drive. The car was symbolic of Eben's excesses, to all of which he felt entitled.
Up felt abject remorse for having had a hand in the shaping of Eben's character. He bore as much blame as Eben's indulgent parents. He had approved and negotiated all the bribes that had swept the boy's lifetime of misdeeds under the rug. As he climbed the stairs to his bedroom, he submitted to the guilt, worry, and weariness that mantled him like chains.
Theo still resided in the townhouse village where he'd lived when Eben had left for prison. His unit was sandwiched between two others that were identical to his, except for the color of their front door. Eben tapped the brass knocker on the cobalt blue door. Theo answered and, seeing Eben there, looked at him with puzzlement.
Eben? Were you expecting someone else?
I wasn't expecting you.
He hesitated, then said,
But come on in.
I believe I will.
Eben walked into the main room, which had undergone a facelift during his absence.
I like the makeover.
New? Last year.
Eben strolled over to the island that separated the living area from the kitchen, ran his hand along the marbled surface, and made a tisking sound.
Foe, I hope you weren't rooked into paying for the real thing.
Theo hadn't moved far from the door where he stood, hands on hips.
You're stoned.
Eben grinned. Stoned, but not stingy.
He pulled a plastic pill bottle from his front pants pocket.
Molly's. Catch.
He tossed the bottle to Theo, who caught it, then pitched it overhanded back to him.
No thanks. I saw our friend Simply Simon the other night. He said he hadn't seen you in a long, long time. Did you switch dealers or what?
It's late, Eben. I was on my way to bed. Let's pick a night next week and meet for dinner. How about it?
Eben tapped his chin with his index finger.
You know what that sounded like? It sounded like a brush-off. A classic brush-off.
Theo dropped his head forward and stared down at his bare feet. Really ugly, bony feet. When he raised his head, he said,
Look, Eben, I'm glad you're out. It's good to see you, but I don't do that shit anymore.
He indicated the plastic bottle that Eben was bouncing in his palm, rattling the tablets.
Seriously? Did you have a bad experience with mind-altering drugs?
Theo had always reminded Eben of Forrest Gump, endearingly naive and easily swayed. But right now, his scowl better resembled Cal's disapproving expression at their recent dinner.
A bad experience? He said. Yes, wouldn't you say we all had a bad experience?
Oh, Eben drawled. You're referring to...
He rapidly snapped his fingers.
The Pratt chick, the Cleopatra lookalike. I'm glad you brought her up. She's the reason I came to see you tonight.
Well, indirectly. Roundaboutly.
Do you have anything to drink?
No.
He sighed.
Okay, I can tell you're pissy. You were on your way to bed. I showed up stoned. I don't mean to be...
No, I get it. He patted the air with both hands. I'll hurry this along. Have a seat.
Theo hesitated, then moved to a chair and sat down on the edge of the seat as though he didn't intend to be there for long. Eben threw himself into the most comfortable chair in the room. Once he got settled, he told Theo what he'd learned from his dad.
I thought he'd gone senile on me, but Up confirmed it.
Theo looked worried.
That's double jeopardy.
See, that's what I thought, but apparently not. Up says probably nothing will come of it,
Any further due process will fall by the wayside because Rebecca Pratt still lives. But, you know, he shrugged. If there was to be a reopening of the case, you, Cal, and I might recollect things about that night a little differently than we did at the first trial. Shit, he chortled. We were so wasted. Even the following morning at the police station when we were being questioned, I couldn't clearly recall how it went down. After all this time, who could accurately remember who said this, who said that, or who did what to whom? He pinned Theo to his chair with a knowing stare. It would be better all around if our memories stayed foggy. Don't you agree? He let the question settle. Then he sighed again. This prosecutor obviously has a bee up her butt. I can just see her, can't you? Saggy tits, thick ankles, mannish hands. Probably an unsightly wart somewhere. I'd like to look her up on Google or something, but I'm rusty as hell on the computer. I don't want to ask anybody in the company to research her because my curiosity would inevitably get back to my old man and up, and they're already overwrought. So I thought of you. You're a librarian. Libraries are chock full of information, right? You could dig where nobody else could. It was obvious to Even that Theo had read between the lines of everything he'd said. His brow was furrowed. His leg was jiggling. He was gnawing the inside of his cheek. What kind of information do you want on her? That's my man, Even slapped his thigh. I knew I could count on you. I want to know every fucking thing, even the location of that unsightly wart. Theo swallowed, nodded. Okay, in my spare time, I could... Even made the quiz show buzzer sound. No good. Give it top priority. Theo's grin was lopsided, visibly forced and uneasy, but, as expected, acquiescent. What's her name? Chapter 17. Zach woke up and cursed himself even before opening his eyes. He just had to go and do it, hadn't he? He'd kissed her, which, in their situation, had been a violation of ethics, plus piling on another complication that this situation did not need. Fool that he was, he'd thought that a little experimentation would satisfy his curiosity, and that would be the end of it. But her willing response to his feeler had shot that hypothesis all to hell. Swearing under his breath, he threw back the covers and got up. He pulled on his hiking gear in stages while scrambling a couple of eggs and brewing strong coffee, which he consumed quickly. He was eager to get on the trail, burn off some pent-up frustration, and clear his head. But even as he watched for the familiar landmarks along his path, his mind continued to rewind to the thrill of that first, and technically only, kiss. The tentative lips-to-lips touch had led to a tempered exploration of tongues, which had rapidly escalated into a deeper, wetter, hungrier merging of mouths. She'd come up on her tiptoes and curled one arm around his neck. He'd bracketed her hips between his hands and had drawn her up higher and closer, then against him, then right there. But the perfect matchup had lasted only for a few fragmented heartbeats before she'd moaned as she'd slid her arms from around his neck, stood flat-footed again, and planted her hand in the center of his chest. Zach, we can't. We've established that. But even as he'd said it, he'd moved in for more. We can't. She applied more pressure to his chest. They'd held like that for a moment, then he'd given a curt nod, released her, and stepped away. Get inside. Lock your door. On the matter of Rebecca, I'll wait to hear from you. He'd bobbed his head. Good night, Zach. Night. He hadn't had the wherewithal to say anything more. Once Kate was safely inside the cottage, he'd plunged into the downpour, clambered into his truck, and driven home. His windshield wipers had labored at top speed, but they were ineffectual against the hard rainfall which drummed against the roof of the cab. Hardly a soothing sound, it set his teeth on edge. He'd arrived home wearing sodden clothes, his skin feverish with lust, his cock iron hard,
and mad as hell. Had Bing known about his condition, he would have had a field day, railing at him for being out of line, out of his mind, and out of luck. "Because," Bing would have said, "this Catherine Cartwright Lennon sounds like a gal with an unshakable sense of purpose and uncompromising integrity." And Bing would have been right. Which is why, when Bing had asked him what the state prosecutor was like, Zach had kept his answer factual, but had said nothing that would lead Bing to suspect that Zach would sacrifice his sound judgment, much less his pride, for one kiss. One kiss straight out of a wet dream. But still, during his descent, he'd been so preoccupied with recollections of that consequential kiss that now, when he reached the rocky riverbed at the foot of the mountain, it came almost as a surprise that he'd arrived. This spot beneath the falls represented to him healing springs. At his lowest, he would venture down here seeking validation and rejuvenation, and somehow had always garnered the will to make the more difficult hike back up. The falls were roaring. The boulders beneath the cascade created furious whitewater. Zach took a minute to admire the raw and unbridled energy of the churning waters. He then turned to look downstream, where the current's ferocity abated. Yet for miles it continued, its inexorable tumble over rocks worn smooth by millennia of aquatic polishing. He'd stood in this spot hundreds of times before, admiring the beauty of it all, marveling over nature's endurance, its permanence in defiance of cataclysmic upheavals. It never failed to awe him. Today, it also cemented his resolve. He began his arduous uphill trek and cut one full minute off his time. Green Ridge Incorporated had carved out a half moon of forested acreage on which to situate its regional headquarters. The sales office was the only completed structure. Home models were in various stages of construction. Workers were on site. Temporary buildings and portable restrooms were lined up along the arced perimeter of the clearing. Zach parked in front of the office. As he entered, he had to admit it was classy. On his left was an elaborate coffee bar. On his right, a counter stocked with soft drinks, bottled water, and bowls of fresh fruit. In dead center was a reception desk, which no one was attending. The mountain face was on display through a wall of windows, but he noticed that the unsightly grouping of portable toilets wasn't in view. A young woman appeared through an open doorway on the coffee bar side. "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know anybody had come in." "Just now." She walked over to him and formed a perfect southern girl with grandma's pearls and manners smile. "I'm Penelope." "Zach Bridger." Her scarlet lips formed a perfect O, and she became flustered. "Mr. Bridger, welcome. How can I help you?"
"Penelope, I'll take it from here."
Zach turned toward the voice. A man stood in the doorway through which Penelope had emerged. Looking like she'd just been thrown a life preserver, she said, "Mr. Parks is our GM. He'll help you."
"Thank you."
Zach approached the man, who held out his right hand to him.
"Mackie Parks," he said as they shook hands. "No introduction to you is necessary. Come on back."
He was 50-ish, with ruddy cheeks and thinning hair, paunchy in the way of men who toil for long hours at a desk but never break a sweat. He led Zach into an office furnished much like Zach's home, mountain chic, perfectly suited to the mountain setting without taking on corniness. Zach sat in the tartan plaid chair he was motioned into. It was one that formed a circular grouping in front of the window. Parks sat and gave Zach a lengthy and unabashed appraisal. Zach was about to ask if he'd passed inspection when Parks said,
"I've hoped that someday I'd have the pleasure of meeting you. I confess to having been a huge fan." "Having been, not so much a fan now."
Parks chuckled.
"You've been a pain in the ass." "I wouldn't be if you'd leave me alone and stop sending people to my house. We covet your side of the mountain and want to buy it. It's not for sale.
Money is no object.
Money is irrelevant. I won't sell for any amount. Period. End of that discussion.
Zack leaned forward in his chair to mark a shift in topic.
As much as I object to what you're doing over here, I would never destroy or damage your property. I haven't sneaked over here in the middle of the night with a can of spray paint. I haven't broken any windows or torn down signs. None of that.
Parks tilted his head and looked at him curiously.
I don't understand.
Stop sicking Dave Morris on me. The deputy sheriff? Yeah, him. The one with the hat. We've had two encounters, both antagonistic. I told him the first time he came snooping that I had nothing to do with the vandalism going on over here.
Parks seemed both stunned and defensive.
Well, I'm glad to know that, but your denial is unnecessary, Mr. Bridger. Nobody in this organization has suspected you of such.
Kate was used to the sound of other lodgers' cars coming and going past her cottage, so she thought nothing of hearing one arrive until there was a knock on her door. She went to the window and pulled aside the curtain. Zack saw her and chinned a greeting. Trying to ignore the spike in her heart rate, she let the curtain drop back into place, then unlocked the door and opened it.
He said, "Good morning."
"Good morning."
"Too early to come calling?"
"No, I've been up."
"Am I disturbing?"
"I'm packing."
"Heading back to Atlanta?"
"Last night you told me you didn't want to be rushed while making a decision about Rebecca. I can't stay here indefinitely, so I'm going home to await further word from you."
"Makes sense, I guess."
He rubbed his scruffy chin with the back of his hand.
"I don't want to hold you up, but I've got something I'd like to run past you. I'll make it quick. Could mean something, could mean nothing."
"You've at least piqued my interest. The room's a mess. Let me grab a jacket."
She left the door standing ajar while pulling on the jacket. For good measure, she retrieved a scarf she'd already placed in her suitcase and looped it round her neck. Glancing in the mirror, she fluffed up the hair on the crown of her head. He really should break his bad habit of showing up without notice. As she went out, she said, "There's a trail." She pointed to a signpost. "It makes a circuit."
"Lead on."
They entered the trailhead single file, then he moved up beside her. The path was strewn with fallen leaves and dotted with puddles from last night's rain. As they maneuvered around them, their hips bumped, hands brushed, reminding her of their kiss, replays of which had kept her awake and restless for most of the night. What had she been thinking? Certainly not about the jeopardy in which she was placing her career, or the chink it could create in her resolve to get justice, which depended solely on his heart-wrenching decision. She hadn't been thinking about any of the wrongness of that embrace. What she'd been thinking is that she wanted to climb him and cling to that marvelous physique like a vine while feasting on his mouth. She still wanted to.
"You look different this morning," he said.
"Different how?"
"I've never seen you in anything other than a business suit."
"I have other garments in my wardrobe."
He grinned.
"You sure as hell do justice to those jeans."
Her cheeks warmed, but she kept her response lighthearted.
"Thanks. Is that what could mean something, could mean nothing?"
"No, that definitely meant something."
Their gazes locked for a couple of seconds, then both returned to looking down at the path. He kicked at a muddy stone and pushed his hands into the pockets of his leather jacket.
"I came straight here from a conversation with the general manager of Green Ridge, a guy named Mackie Parks. We had an interesting chat."
She gave a soft laugh.
"I don't doubt that."
"Not interesting in the way you're thinking, Kate."
Before he could elaborate, a woman came around a bend in the pathway. She was being dragged by two leashed golden retrievers. While Kate exchanged greetings with the woman, Zack bent down to scratch each of the exuberant dogs behind the ears, then waited for them to move past before he resumed.
"I went to Green Ridge this morning to make it clear that I wasn't selling my property, ever. and then to make it even clearer that I wasn't vandalizing their development, I told Parks to stop sicking Deputy Morris on me.
What was his response? When he halted, so did she, and turned to face him.
He said nobody over there has ever associated me with the vandalism. They suspect some kids, a group of pothead punks from one town over, who have prior arrests for that kind of destructive mischief. He said my name has never come up in regards to that, only that I'm a pain in the ass for holding out and not selling. He didn't dispatch Morris to check me out, and had no explanation for why Morris had taken that upon himself.
Do you believe him?
Parks? Yeah, I do. I don't like him scarring up the mountainside, but he seemed like a straight shooter.
I don't understand. Why would Dave Morris pick on you?
Because of you?
She thought it over, then shook her head. The timing doesn't fit. When I arrived at your house to find him there, he seemed genuinely surprised to see me. I don't think he knew until then that we were acquainted. He does resent the Super Bowl MVP, though. He remarked on it. They fell into step again.
I could be reading too much into it, he said. He looks like an ex-jock. Maybe he's jealous of my glory days. Maybe his curiosity got the better of him. He wanted to check out the has-been, and the vandalism gave him a plausible excuse. I've made it no secret that I'm opposed to the development.
They walked on a bit, and then he elbowed her in the side.
He'll hate seeing you go.
Again, they laughed quietly, although there was no one around to hear them. They hadn't met anyone on the trail except for the lady with the dogs. The woods were supernaturally still. The only sound was that of their footfalls sifting through the fallen leaves. Those two fell silent when they stopped simultaneously and faced each other. She said, I need to turn back and get on the road. I notified my office that I would be there by mid-afternoon.
How much longer is this circuit?
You'll do it in 20 minutes.
I'm going to continue on then. I've got a lot to think about.
She smiled with empathy. Zach, whatever you decide will be the right decision. Either way, make it a choice you can live with, without regret or self-reproach. Make it right for you.
I want to make it right for Rebecca.
That choked her up. She had all the compassion in the world for Rebecca Pratt, but she'd been incredibly stupid not to value this man while she had him.
I'll be waiting to hear from you.
Rain is still in the forecast. Drive safely.
I will. He took a step closer.
Goodbye, kiss.
Zach.
I know. I hate it like hell, but I know.
She relented, saying softly,
on the cheek.
He took an end of her scarf in each hand and wound them around a couple of turns, then pulled her up and forward. He pressed his lips to her cheek, held there, and exhaled a warm breath. Then he stepped back and unwound the scarf from his hands. Without another word, he started off down the trail.
Chapter 18. Even as a child, if he was ever caught doing what other people considered to be wrong, Eben would use a passive-aggressive tactic, behave as though he had every right to be where he was, doing whatever he was doing. He hadn't known the psychological term for this method of escaping punishment. He knew only that it was effective, much more so than stealth, which was indicative of shame, and shame was an alien concept to him. His specialness exempted him from censure and correction. Tonight, his undertaking wasn't without risks. The odds of getting caught were greater than those of getting away with it, but he wasn't too worried about it. If ever put on the spot, he was cracking good at worming his way out with a glib explanation. In the unlikely event that failed, his dad's name and checkbook were reliable fallbacks. Because of an overflowing commode in one of the library's bathrooms, Theo hadn't come through with information on Catherine Lennon. He had spent most of his workday mopping up, but had promised to try again tomorrow. Rather than be bested by the soiled pamper that had clogged the toilet,
Eben had decided to screw the delay and see for himself what this Lennon bitch was about. He'd arm-twisted her home address out of Theo, which he'd sent to Eben in a text. What an idiot. If Theo had been to prison, he would know to avoid texting anything you didn't want announced to the world. A single text could be one's undoing. He'd borrowed Frida's car for the venture. Because it looks like rain, and I don't want to expose my new baby to the elements. Not wanting to drive the Porsche in bad weather was a credible reason, but his primary one was that Frida's mid-priced Chevy would blend into traffic and be much harder to tail. Did they, whoever they were, really think he wouldn't spot the surveillance? Hysterical. Last night, as he'd left Theo's townhouse, he'd had to curb the impulse to wave at the guy in the nondescript sedan parked two doors down. Frida had handed over her car key without a quibble, asking only that he be back no later than 10 o'clock. He gave her a couple of $100 for the overtime and timed his departure with when she usually left for the day. The sedan didn't follow as he drove out of the gate at dusk and set out for Catherine Lennon's neighborhood. Her address was on a street lined with charming houses with shutters and flower beds and the stars and stripes hanging